The Max Kellerman Show, the podcast.
The sultry tones you hear right now are obviously not Max Kellerman. He's got some voice issues he's got today off.
Sultry tones? Yeah. I'm not talking.
That is fair. Her voice sounds great. Mine is the usual rasp of like, oh my God, it's going to go away. She's Sarah Spain. I'm Jason Fitz. Spain and Fitz is sitting in for the Max Kellerman Show. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. All of our guests join us on the Goodyear Hotline. If you've never hung out with Sarah and I, shame on you. Where you been? We hang out on ESPN Radio every night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern. You can also check out the Spain and Fitz podcast wherever you get your podcast, which is a great way to hear some exclusive content that you only get there, usually involving some naughty words and strange content. So it's fun. Sarah, there is some big breaking news today, and that is that the Eagles have fired coach Doug Peterson. A source told ESPN's Dan Graziano, ending a partnership that delivered the first and only Super Bowl title in the city's history. And it's funny because I remember early in the year sitting on radio and asking some guests, you know, what happens if this thing goes awry? What if, when things look so terrible at the start, what if the wheels fall off and this is a 4-12 football team? Doug Peterson gone? And the overwhelming response was no. I mean, nobody would have imagined that. Everybody seemed to think that winning a Super Bowl a few years ago would be enough to keep you your job. But that is not the case, as we now see an organization having to make tough decisions. They've got a bad salary cap situation. They don't know what they're doing at their quarterback position moving forward. Philly fans are, let's say, not the most cuddly patient in the world. Like, this is not the easiest situation to have. And so now they've decided to part ways, which tells you they think that the key is bringing a new voice in.
Well, and the key to that is that when you ask people that question early in the season, the specifics would have to have been included in your question, which you couldn't have known then. But if it was, and Carson Wentz is leading the league in interceptions and sacks taken and is completely ineffective and then loses his connection to that head coach, can you see him sticking around? And the difference is the financial commitment. And I've seen some very smart people throughout this, even as we were being assured that Doug Peterson would keep his job, saying, Wentz is going to stick around. Wentz is going to be the guy. And it is because of that contract and that financial commitment that they ended up deciding it is much easier to get out of the Doug Peterson business than it is to get out of the Carson Wentz business right now.
Well, and that's what it always comes down to, right? Like, I constantly tell everybody it's easier to change one person than it is to change 53. Like, but the change of one person, and that person being Doug Peterson, means new coach, which means new regime, which means new voice, new mindset. You know, I think part of this, though, isn't just about, you know, the relationship with Carson Wentz, but to the point we're making. The minute you decided that you were going to pull Jalen Hurts so late in that game, as we talked about in the moment, I have no problem with every organization deciding to do what they're going to do. But it makes it difficult for Doug Peterson to talk to those other players that were still on the field and get them to buy in.
If he tried to spin it as front office, they must not have bought it, because there was a chance to try to save that relationship. It doesn't sound like it happened.
Yeah, and difficult for anybody to buy in. Hey, sacrifice everything. Give us what you got. We're here to win, unless it doesn't serve our purposes. Like, that's just all a difficult sort of bridge for them to cross. So now the Eagles have to figure out what's next. And realistically, I think Doug Peterson becomes one of, if not the hottest coaching candidates on the market, given the fact that he has won a Super Bowl in Philadelphia. Like, I don't want to reduce that, even though the end of this has looked so ugly.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have plenty of time to talk about that, but let's talk some playoff football.
Okay, fine. I mean, we'll just go straight into it. I thought you didn't want to talk. Oh, just the one game you
just
don't
want
to talk.
Just the one game that I think, you know, there wasn't much to take away from it other than, you know, clean house and fire everybody and let's get better next year.
That would be Saints Bears if anybody isn't sure. Now, I will say probably that one of the more interesting games coming into it on Spain and Fitz, we picked all of the games Friday night. And all week I tried to make some compelling case on why I thought maybe the Washington football team could do the impossible. That was just me trying to justify the fact that, you know, Tom Brady, it was a fumble. There's no such thing as a tuck. But realistically, that game was closer than I expected. I mean, there were some shocking things in that game. The fact that Brady stayed so upright. I mean, that defensive line really didn't get after him the way that I expected that they would. And then the other side of it was watching a Washington football team that I thought's offense would be anemic and brutal. And instead, they came out and they played really efficient and good football. Like, I think he looked good in one game.
Yeah. If you had told me that the least competitive team in Saturday's slate of games would be the Seahawks before this week started.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Which is wild. And as many cracks as this division took, and very deservedly so, they gave us a really good game. And again, I want to give credit to the people out on the field, to Ron Rivera, to the folks involved in creating the football product for the WTFs, because they got past every single off-the-field thing that they had to deal with. They got past multiple injured quarterbacks, and they put together a really enjoyable game against a really good team. Now, they didn't get to Brady as much as I thought they needed to for that to be a game plan that would get them the win, but they stuck with it. I'm telling you, that Heinicke escaping the pocket on third down when they were down, I think, 18-10 in the third, and that dive to the pylon was a full-on Superman moment where he jumped at the four and made it. I mean, it was that, and then that beautiful ball to Steven Sims in the back with the toe drag. I mean, there were moments in that game, again, where you're watching, and as a Bears fan, I'm always impressed by what looks like real offense. And so when you have your third string quarterback doing what he did against a Bucs team that has been up and down, but a lot of people feel pretty strong about, I was just happy that they gave us such a good game.
I don't disagree with any of that. And frankly, I heard somebody on ESPN radio over the weekend, forgive me for not remembering who, saying Heinicke just gave himself a career. Maybe not as a starter, but that's the sort of guy, you've seen that effort. Like, he can be a clipboard carrier at the very least for a long time. With that being said, Bruce Arians, Bucs head coach, he did not mince words at his press conference about the defense and what he thought.
We were tackling worth a whole game, and we finally got him when it mattered. And, you know, I don't think it was best our defense has played in a long time. I mean, it's terrible. I'm never going to apologize for winning, and next week.
Wow, Arians is not usually a guy that stumbles over his words and kind of sounds exasperated, even when he's throwing people under the bus for whatever they've done. He sounded truly disappointed. And I will tell you, as much as I just lauded the WTFs for showing up, that was not a good showing from the Bucs in terms of feeling confident about them advancing in the playoffs. Like, that was not a team that you looked at and thought, ooh, they've really got a shot to keep this going. They barely eked past a team that was under 500.
Well, and you and I have echoed this sentiment all year long. Who you play matters in this year's NFL particularly. So, you know, how they looked against a Washington football team that is not particularly spectacular, and how their defense looked against a bad Washington football team offense. There is some element that's a takeaway from that. It's the Max Kellerman Show. Sarah Spain, Jason Fitz, we're in for Max. Saturday felt like a heartbreaking day for fans across the board, because I think back to the first game we got. And the first game we got on Saturday was Bills-Colts. And I don't know that I've ever seen a team lose more close challenges, a team lose more close opportunities. I sat there thinking, if it was the Raiders that were suffering the fate of the Colts on that Saturday, I think I might have died during the course of the day. Like, the level of just angst and anger when you're watching the Bills just drive down the field, have two different calls that are reviewed, and it was the call stands because there wasn't conclusive evidence. Yeah, I mean, you got all sorts of different little breaks that went the way of the Bills, and that takes nothing away from Buffalo. It was just an incredibly frustrating day to be a Colts fan as they take the L in a close game.
Well, and a frustrating day to be analytics Twitter, or someone who believes in actually looking at the analytics, because Frank Reich was right to go for it. And when a coach makes the right statistical decision in the right moment and it doesn't work, it is so frustrating for the people who always advocate for that decision making. Because then we saw in later games during the weekend, coaches that were punting on 4th-and-2, coaches that were making terrible decisions according to analytics. And that's much more frustrating to me than someone making the right move and not having it go well that time. And that's what happened with Reich there. But I mean, Fitz, what did you expect other than Philip Rivers, length of the field, no timeouts, down 7, 2 minutes to go? I mean, that is the story of his lifetime. And as much as I don't think they got that call right at the end, I'm actually glad it didn't end on that call, because it would have been a dissatisfying way to end that game. The result still ended up going the way of the Bills, deservedly so. But if that call had been made and it had been a bad call, which I think it might have been, you might have ended up just the game. I think the call was bad, but it made the ending of the game more satisfying.
I agree 1,000%. And shame on the NFL officiating Twitter account, which came out and tried to justify it afterwards by showing one screenshot of the only angle that didn't really conclusively tell you anything. I thought the broadcast did a great job. And we've become so conditioned to this, right? Like, we're frame by frame on these replays. I thought it was a terrible call at the end. And I have to give, at least as somebody echoed on Twitter over the weekend, at least the previous regime of NFL officiating would come out and say, hey, we didn't get that call right. It feels like the current regime is going to find some reason to tell you why it was right, and it simply wasn't. To that end, though, I mean, for the Colts, you've got a roster that's been built incredibly efficiently. That's a very smart team. It's a very good football team, but they don't have a long-term solution at quarterback. And, you know, we can look at Phillip Rivers all day long and say, okay, what was this year? But I don't think the Colts run it back with Phillip Rivers. And this is that sort of reminder that as upset as we seem to get every time a team like the Packers maybe goes in early on a quarterback, I'd rather see a team go in early on a quarterback and make things difficult than see a team like the Colts or the Steelers get stuck where they are today, where they got to run it back next year and their quarterback is not going to be a viable solution.
Well, and it's Spain and Fitz filling in for Max Kellerman on ESPN Radio. It was fascinating to me how watching that Colts game and watching Phillip Rivers and thinking about what might be next for them reminded me of how Andrew Luck has disappeared from the face of the earth. By virtue of giving interviews, no feature stories, no TV interviews, no radio, by literally intentionally disappearing, we spent so much less time talking about how wild it is that he just walked away.
I hadn't even, like, through the entire course of watching the game, I never once thought, what about Luck? And what about Luck? I mean, that would absolutely be the craziest scenario. It's like you never would have thought that Andrew Luck would have just walked away from it. Now, that's not where the end of frustrating Saturdays was for fans. As the other game, I think if you were a Seahawks fan, and you came in. And it's funny. I saw
poor Mina.
I know. I immediately thought of Mina.
All the memes. Mima Kimes is her name now.
I saw Mina in the halls on Friday and socially distanced and both wearing masks, just to reiterate. And as we stood there, I said, what game do you feel like is the most uncomfortable? And we had her on Friday night. She echoed the same sentiment, Seahawks-Rams. Mm-hmm. And I walked away from it saying, Mina, come on, that's just because you're a Seahawks fan and most of us as fans get really nervous in the playoffs. I did not believe it. And it would have been unthinkable to think that Goff comes in just removed from surgery on his thumb. Obviously, they intended to go with the backup. The backup takes a terrible, terrible looking hit, is taken to the hospital in the game, and now Goff is forced into action with pins in his thumb and it seems incapable of throwing the football. And despite that, the Seahawks could not take advantage of it, and the Rams absolutely run away with the game. I was stunned by that outcome.
Well, we talked to Mina about this on Friday, and I said, how strange is it that if you went to the beginning of the season, all we were talking about was let Russ cook, how this Seahawks offense was so unstoppable, and it was just their defense that was letting them down. Where in the case of the Rams, like, they had a bunch of games early in the season where they were absolutely obliterating teams with some pretty decent offense, very inconsistent. But in the end, what we ended up talking about instead was, can the Seahawks defense be improved enough over the last 8 games to hold up against a weakened offense that was either going to be with Wolford, like you said, injured, or with Goff not at his 100%? And how good can the Rams defense, which was great all year, be against the Seahawks offense that used to be unstoppable? And that conversation was surprising to me that that's where we ended up. It was all about the defensive sides of the ball here. And man, there were so many elements of this. You know, there were the mistakes from the Seahawks down the stretch that were so frustrating. The dropped ball, the fumble on the return. Then there was stuff like Cam Akers having a game like that. He didn't play for like the last 3 weeks, or he was out 2 games and was completely ineffective in week 17. And then he comes out and does what he did. I mean, there's just so many things that had to go the right way for the Rams and so many mistakes and bad decisions made by the Seahawks. I would be incredibly frustrated as a Seahawks fan to have a season like this that did have its up and downs end the way it did.
Yeah, well, and for Russ to go 11 of 27, I think part of what was concerning, if you're a Seahawks fan, is that Russ just looked like he couldn't find anybody. Nobody was open. He was running around for dear life, even when he wasn't necessarily being pressured. It just felt like he'd gotten enough pressure that at some point he was just running around to wait for guys to get open and then taking bad hits because of it. He was sacked 5 times in a QBR of 17.6. Like, think about that for a guy that only a couple of months ago, people were absolutely up in arms and offended that he'd never gotten an MVP vote, you know, and then you think about, and I'm not saying that he's never been deserving, but it's just a reminder that the book is not finished until the season's over. That sort of lingering moment for Russ is going to sit in the minds of that fan base all offseason.
Well, and that's the other thing we talked about on Friday, though, is for whatever reason, this is a Seahawks team that was 10-0 at home. This is a Russ who was undefeated in the playoffs at home. 10-0 at home in the playoffs, I'm saying, in the last stretch. And for whatever reason, they've had problems with the Rams. They have not had the same success against the Rams in the past. And you saw it this time. Coming into this game, Russ had 1 passing touchdown and 3 interceptions in the 3 games since the Rams got Jalen Ramsey. He just had not figured out the coverage that they were giving. And so I was surprised by the result. But a lot of people thought this was going to be more of a blowout game, and to me it felt like the Rams D was going to keep it close.
Well, you were absolutely right about that portion of it. We did not agree Friday night. I thought the Seahawks were going to be able to have their way with them. I didn't figure the Rams could get any offense. Oops! Goff finishes 9-19, 155. But again, it should be noted that he did it with two screws still in his thumb on his throwing hand, which is alarming. This is what Sean McVay, Rams head coach, had to say about Goff's performance at his press conference afterwards.
I think it says a lot about his ability to prepare himself mentally to be ready to go. For him to even be able to throw the football is pretty impressive. There were a couple limitations, as you guys saw, which is what led to the decision to go with John. And I was really pleased with Jared, and I think it's a real credit to him just being able to handle this week the right way and have himself mentally ready to go. And, you know, there you go. He ends up playing the majority of the game for us.
Well, and to that end, now he's going to have to figure out what to do against Green Bay. Like, you have the number one defense in the league against the number one scoring offense in one of the matchups coming this weekend. But that Rams defense, even when Aaron Donald was out, that Rams defense looked bigger, faster, stronger, better than anything that the Seahawks could handle.
Yeah, the thing with the Rams is they are so inconsistent that you want to look at that game and say, I'm going to build off what we saw and take it moving forward. And instead, it's more like, I don't know. I don't know what that offense is going to show up with. I was surprised by that performance, even though I had seen and firsthand in a primetime game against the Bears just how dominant that squad can be. The inconsistency makes it tough to predict.
Well, and this is a tough message, I think, for everybody to hear today that just watched their season come to an end. But, Sarah, I say this every year. When your team finishes their year and it doesn't result in a Super Bowl, I think like 48 to 72 hours afterwards, you have the most honest look at your team that you will ever have for the rest of the year. It's like a bad relationship. Like right when you break up, you realize everything is just gone to hell, right? And then a few months later, you're like, you know what? I do remember this one thing. That's free agency. And then It's like, oh, man, you know, this one moment that we always had, that's the draft. By the time you get to practice in the summer, you're like, you know, it wasn't all arguments and You've gotten yourself into training camp. So like today,
well, that's my biggest concern with the Bears, and we talked about that as well, is I need them to feel fresh in the vibes of that completely anemic offense, of that terrible, brutal, ugly, embarrassing second half where someone just alerted me on Twitter, I think Heinicke actually was the fourth string for the WTFs, not even the third. The fourth string quarterback for that team looked a billion times better than our former AP Coach of the Year, Matt Nagy's offensive genius paired with Maserati Mitch Trubisky to amount for absolutely nothing. And I don't want that Bears front office to get far enough away from this absolute turd of a performance to say, you know what, maybe we should try again with Pace and with Nagy and with Trubisky. Absolutely not. This team backdoored their way into the postseason, and they made just some more money on the way because maybe someone bought a Bears sweatshirt for Sunday's game, and that is it. Move on. Everybody got to go.
I think that's a common message right now for Colts fans, for Seahawks fans, for Titans fans. Y'all got to look at your teams today and say what's wrong, because you'll get the most honest answer. You might write it down, revisit it this summer when suddenly you're back in love with your ex. All right,
put it in a box, bury it in your backyard, dig it up in a couple months, and then see how you felt.
You're like, I love her again. And then you look back at the list, you're like, I don't love her. She was crazy.
The Max Kellerman Show, the podcast.
At some point, Greg Roman, the offensive coordinator for the Baltimore Ravens, say, hey, I have Lamar Jackson.
Jackson trying to escape and run for it, and he's got it more. Lamar Jackson.
I think the reality is neither of these teams like each other.
Yeah, Mike, the decision to punt on 4th-and-2, can you kind of walk us through your thought process on that?
No, just decided to punt. We gave a game ball to Lamar for his first playoff win, and now we're looking forward to the next one.
It's the Max Kellerman Show on ESPN Radio, ESPN Plus, the ESPN app, and SiriusXM Channel 80. And, of course, on your smart speaker, you can just say, hey, smart speaker, play ESPN Radio. Of course, this is not the voice of Max Kellerman. It's getting a little rest. He needs his beauty sleep. His voice has got to get right. So, in the meantime, they've let Spain and Fitz take over. Sarah Spain, Jason Fitz. The show is presented by Progressive Insurance. Guests join us on the Goodyear Hotline. There have been a lot of hot takes, Sarah, and we like to do this on Mondays. We like to go through and give you a little bit of like hot take. You know, we're a judge. We're judge and jury for hot takes on Mondays. There have been a lot of hot takes over the course of the season about the overall state of the Baltimore Ravens. At times, people at the beginning of the year, too hot, and then everybody went too cold. And it's like Goldilocks. Now maybe everybody's finally normalized. And so we get a Titans-Ravens playoff matchup in Tennessee, by the way, of the five home playoff games that the Titans have hosted since the year 2004 have been against the Ravens. So this is a two teams that are used to facing each other. They get into this playoff game, and the Ravens absolutely, to me, do the one thing I never expected. They shut down the Titans offense. They made the Titans offense look absolutely anemic, not just shutting down Derrick Henry as much as everybody focuses on that, but also shutting down an electric passing game that's capable of getting chunk yardage. The Titans could do nothing against a Ravens defense that seemed better prepared and ready to be and outcoached, frankly. They did a better job in every facet of the game.
Well, to your point about the takes coming in, the biggest question marks were around these so-called narratives that we've decided about Lamar Jackson in such a short amount of time. And they were backed up by facts, but a very limited small sample of facts, right? And so then he had the opportunity, after Tennessee took that lead early on, to disprove them. One of them was, had never come back with a 10-0 deficit, right? Had never come back when his team was down by 10 points or more. Also, never won a playoff game. Again, only had two options, two tries at it, but we still like to create big stories out of nothing because it makes for louder radio shows. So he had the opportunity to do both. And then he had the third opportunity against an absolutely brutal Tennessee pass coverage D that was fourth in the regular season to do it with his arm. Now, he didn't quite do that, right? We still haven't seen the game from him at a postseason level where it's all about can he pass his way through it. He used his legs, and he's going to because that's what he's got. Now, that's not a shot at his arm. It's just when you can move like he does, especially that one play fits on the touchdown run where he looked like he could have been tackled six different times on that. And you saw a guy, and in any other player, that guy's got the angle on him. And you're watching, and then you put it in slow-mo, and it becomes even more clear that he is just so fast that even when these defenders have an angle, they can't bring him down. It all came together, though, to allow him to shout down some pretty loud narratives, and whether or not he believed them and they would have affected him in the future. I mean, there's real ones like Kirk Cousins in primetime. I'm gonna give you that. Like, there's enough of a sample size where I'm gonna give you that. But this stuff on Lamar was just based on the expectations and the high level of praise he's given for the regular season that hasn't translated to the postseason. Small sample size, though.
This is one of those moments where I loudly scream to the hilltops. The NBA and the NFL are different. I think it's one thing to look at NBA with the limited roster sizes and how individualistic the matchups can be at times. I think it's fair to look at it and say, okay, how are we judging this player by whatever they're accomplishing or not accomplishing in the playoffs? Giannis Antetokounmpo's playoff struggles are a real story. I think that's a fair thing to do. The NFL is a much different beast. So when you have Lamar Jackson, who I'll never forget sitting there, Mike Golick Jr. and I were getting ready for the national championship game a couple of years ago. We were sitting in San Francisco. We're at the hotel, and everybody's watching in the hotel bar. Lamar Jackson just looked like trash in his first ever playoff game. Last year, he did not. He actually played really well in that playoff game. They just didn't win. And the funny thing is, I'd make the argument this year, in many ways, he wasn't as good as he was last year. But now, oh glory, hallelujah, they won the game as a team. This game, this win to me, wasn't as much about Lamar as it was about Wink Martindale, the defensive coordinator for the Ravens, having a better game plan. I mean, absolutely just stifled the Titans offense, which was stunning to me. It's not stunning that Derrick Henry couldn't get going. Fine, you want to take one thing away? Maybe you found the magic that day. But the fact that Tannehill looks so out of rhythm, the fact that they just couldn't get anything going as an offense, is a statement to why they won this game. As much as Lamar made some dynamic plays, it's that Ravens defense that won them the game. So it's funny that it's that changes the narrative to me.
Right. Meanwhile, they were, 5-6 midway through the season, and we had them not making the postseason, and Lamar doesn't have it anymore, and here we are. You mentioned game plan, and absolutely Baltimore's defense was a huge part of it, but some decisions by Tennessee as well. You heard in that rejoin coming back from commercial that, can you tell us why you wanted to punt there? We wanted to punt, right? That was the explanation. Let me give you a little bit more specifics on that decision. This is from at Surrender Index 90. Tennessee decided to punt to Baltimore from the Baltimore 40 on 4th and 2 with 10:06 remaining in the fourth while losing 13-17. With a surrender index of 138.87, this punt ranks at the 100th percentile of cowardly punts of the 2020 season and the 99.92 percentile of all punts since 2009. As far as statistically deciding that this is the right move for your team, it is the 100th percentile of cowardly for this season.
That's stunning. And, you know, I'll give a lot of credit to the NFL Live crew. They were working their butts off on a megacast on ESPN Plus that I thought was really brilliantly done talking about the analytics. Now, Brett Kern is the punter for the Titans, and he's one of the best punters in the league. And I understand that at some point you say, okay, well, we're going to punt. We're going to play a field position game. But not when you have the Titans defense. I don't care how good they're playing in that one particular game. Even if you think your defense is playing lights out, the game of their lives, the best game that this collective unit could ever play, you still got to look at what they've done the entire rest of the season and say, okay, how many times do we want to play Russian roulette with this particular defense? Vrabel making that decision put the entire team in a strange situation, and it ignores your strengths. Your strengths, even if you don't believe is Derrick Henry, you still have one of the league's better wide receivers, one of the league's better quarterbacks, and a dynamic enough play caller in Arthur Smith that everyone believes he's going to be a head coach soon, if not immediately, right? So you put the game in the hands of the strengths for your team, which would be the offense. You got 2 yards. Get creative. Get 2 yards. I thought the lack of aggressiveness there was stunning, and Vrabel's got a lot to answer for because he made that decision as a head coach, and the defense went massively backwards with him as the head coach this year. They've got to fix that wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of questions for that team, and can they run it back? And we haven't heard, quote unquote, the narratives around the Titans the same way, right, as we have for the Ravens. There were not nearly as many questions this year about big sweeping changes, despite the fact that they were a maddeningly inconsistent team. And you and I talked about this on Spain and Fitz, and you were very close to this Titans squad because of your Nashville ties, but a maddeningly inconsistent team. And on the other side is a Ravens team that I think, because the storyline and the talking points around Lamar are so juicy and exciting, we're more likely to zero in when things don't go right. And on the other side, there's a whole lot to talk about, too.
Yeah, well, and Ryan Tannehill had a spectacular season, but he is paid to have a spectacular season. Derrick Henry had a spectacular season, but again, he's paid to be spectacular. They pay certain guys on this team because they believe in him. And taking nothing away from the Titans and their ability to be so good, considering the limitations they had due to injury over the course of the season on their offensive line, that's fine. But in this one particular game, I don't understand what Mike Vrabel was thinking. And at some point, as much as triggered as everyone gets about the conversation about analytics, I think you need a little bit better answer than, well, we just decided to punt. Like, part of the way we get through this is for coaches to acknowledge that analytics exist, but then to acknowledge how they factored into the conversation. That's what people really want, is transparency. All right, coming up, who you got in tonight's national championship game? Last take. We'll give our thoughts, and we'll do that next. But first, Sarah, why don't you tell everybody about this?
The Max Kellerman Show, the podcast. You heard First Take?
At least it's good to hear your voice finally, because I know on First Take, I only hear you on the intro and outro.
Now hear Max's last take.
No, you're not. You're not going to get Max's last take.
I mean, you're going to get double the fun. You'll get two last takes. Sarah, tonight is the College Football Playoff National Championship game presented by AT&T. And obviously, we're going to have a ton of broadcasts for anyone that's looking for an interesting one. Check out ESPNU for the Skycam with intermittent commentary coming from Mike Golick Jr. and myself. So as we
I'll be on the Ocho. That's for my – if you want my part of the megacast – find me on the Ocho.
Look, if we could do an Ocho megacast together, that would be spectacular. The snacks on snacks would be remarkable. So, obviously, we get Alabama versus Ohio State, number one versus number three. Sarah, to me, this is a game that's a little bit about sort of legacy. And by that, I mean, obviously, the legacy is set for Nick Saban. There's no question about that. But everybody every year is like, oh, when's enough enough? Well, in my limited opportunities to talk to Coach, if there's anything I think I've figured out, it's that about 24 hours after, he genuinely forgets all of the success he's already had in his life. So I'm not sure that this makes a huge difference for him. But for Ryan Day, I mean, you're talking about a coach that took over with a huge shadow of Urban Meyer over him, and now he has the opportunity to come in and do this. I mean, Ohio State has not missed a beat since they lost a coach that is so well thought of that every time an opening comes open in the NFL or in college, everybody scrambles for Urban Meyer. And guess what? Ohio State doesn't have Urban anymore. It's a new day, and they're doing just fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think I heard this the other day that Nick Saban's time with Alabama, more than 50% of the time that he has been there, he has been in the national championship game. More times than not, he has started a season and finished that season playing in the national championship game, which is remarkable. So you're right. There's not much of a legacy left there to buoy. There's always going to be people who argue about Bear Bryant or whatever else, but he's already established himself in many ways. There's a lot more on the line for Ryan Day. And there's also, you know, a lot more of, I think, like we talked about earlier, loud radio stems from finding those things that you can attach yourself to and get people to argue about. If Bama wins this, they'll end up playing, what, 13 or 14 games this season. It'll be a different schedule than usual, but most people will think it's the culmination of a fairly regular season comparatively. If Ohio State wins, you can go one of any way. You could say it's even more impressive that they won because they didn't have nearly as much time to tune up for this, and they didn't play very many good teams, and they really had to get themselves ready without being able to play competition that taught them a lot about themselves. Or you could say they didn't get banged up and guys didn't get hurt and they didn't have to show their really good stuff against any teams in a fight to really, you know, make it to this part of the season, and it's not fair that they were there in the first place, and the Big Ten changed rules. I mean, there are so many ways that people could get real fiery and toasty tomorrow about this game if Ohio State pulls it off. Not so much with Bama.
Well, and at some point, everybody's just got to stop with trying to question whether or not Ohio State belonged in the playoff to begin with because of the number of games played. I mean, as much as we can continue to look back and try and revisit that, at some point, you have to look at what happened, which is Ohio State, who I do believe were one of the four best teams in the country, whether people believe it was deserved or not. They get into the playoff, and then they do what they did to Clemson. I mean, we're just sort of glossing over one of the more unexpected things we've seen in college football in a long time, which wasn't Ohio State winning. It's that Ohio State absolutely dominated a Clemson team that we all thought was going to be better coming into the game. Not we all, but many thought were going to be better coming into the game.
Speaking of sort of shocking things, if Waddle does come back tonight, in a season in which he fractured his ankle, if he manages to come back and be even remotely effective, even as a decoy, which they don't need, by the way, because the last thing that Bama needs is more weapons for that offense. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what strategy Ohio State could take to win this game, and I don't want to undersell them because they've already outdone expectations for a lot of people, to your point, taking on that Clemson team that a lot of people thought were going to coast. But how do you cover everybody Bama already has? And then you throw Waddle in there if he's back.
Yeah, you don't. You know, and it's funny, on College Football Live, I was hosting Friday with Pollack and several other analysts. But I asked, Pollack was just so consumed with the fact that you don't shut down Alabama. And I even asked him flat out, I said, okay, what is the game plan that stops Alabama? Like, how would you do it? And he just flat out looked at me and said, you don't, you can't. And if you add Waddle to that offense, now, let's remember, for anyone that doesn't know, Devontae Smith, obviously the first person since 1991 to win the Heisman as a wide receiver, right? He's been incredible, but he wasn't the number one wide receiver on this team coming into the season. I mean, that was Waddle. So if you get him back, like, I mean, he gives them an unlimited amount of things they can do that will trick Ohio State.
But you know how I always say this on our own show, on Spain and Fitz, 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern, regularly on ESPN Radio. You know that I always say this. As soon as everybody is saying the same thing, that is inevitably when it goes wrong. The fact that everyone I've heard is like, there is no way to stop Bama. You can't do it. It won't happen. They're going to be fine. They're going to roll all over them. I'm looking for some tomfoolery tonight. A little bit of trickery, a little strategery.
Well, if there's anything I know, I'm usually wrong on the national championship game picks. I'm taking Bama tonight. Who you got, Sarah?
I got Bama.
Yeah, I mean, there's a moment where I think you're right. It makes me scared, but nothing makes me more scared than Nick Saban. All right, Golic and Chiney are coming up together next. Chiney and Golic Jr., I should call the show the right thing. Thanks for hanging out on the Max Kellerman Show with Spain and Fitz.
Thanks for listening to the Max Kellerman Show. Make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. You can hear the show live weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Radio, ESPN News, or wherever you stream your audio.